This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. As San Antonio celebrates the tricentennial, are we telling the entirety of the city's story? Is enough attention being paid to the contributions of all the groups that helped build this city? San Antonio's African-American history is rich, deep, and complex. There were standout leaders in the Black community that played major roles in the city. The Reverend Claude Black, Ella Austin, Armeticia Bowden, Charles Bellinger, just to name a few. Who else should we be talking about today? How do we make sure that the city's Black heritage is remembered with respect and accuracy? Give us a call. We want to hear your story. The number is 210-614-8980. And do you have stories that you want to share about the African-American experience in San Antonio? 210-614-8980. And you can email us at thesource@tpr.org and tweet us at @tprsource. We're joined by Carrie Lattimore. He is associate professor and the chair of the history department at Trinity University. And Mario Salas, he's a civil rights advocate and former city council member and a professor of the African American Studies Department at the University of Texas at San Antonio. Welcome to The Source, all of you. It's great to have you here.
Thank you.
So let me go to you, Mario Salas. How are we doing on this task of telling all the history of San Antonio?
Well, when I was appointed by the county, there was some concern by County Commissioner Tommy Calvert Jr. About the Black story not being told. And so he appointed me, and I was readily wanting to take on that fight. And for a while under the old leadership, it was very difficult. But since we've had the city with Mr. Contreras take over, we've made some progress. So we've got still some way to go, but at least we've kind of broken through the whole notion of there is no Black history in San Antonio. And you will hear people say that from time to time. So I was more than happy to try and remedy that situation by providing the expertise that I have.
Okay, we're going to talk about some of the forces that have to be dealt with and realize why this is, you put it, a fight to tell this story. You know, and this idea, this canard that there is no Black history in San Antonio. And this is natural. You know, we look back, I mean, going through old newspapers, looking at history books, and typically it's going to tell the story of the establishment and the stories of the power people, people who controlled the money, you know, and typically the people who were not part of that are overlooked in the telling of the story. And so that's the struggle in order to bring that to the fore today, now that we have a better awareness of that there was an entire community with a history and a story to be told. And Carrie Lattimore at Trinity University, can you talk about that?
I mean, I think that one thing that when we look at San Antonio, it's a hard city to kind of characterize, right? It's Southern, but it's also Western. And because of those two, I think sometimes it doesn't have the same kinds of underpinnings as, say, a city like Atlanta or a city like Charlotte or Richmond. But on the other end, it's got this Western flavor. And so I think one of the reasons why it kind of gets left out is because when we see things that were happening in Birmingham or other cities, we see it happen less here. And I think it's also a population situation. The population of San Antonio by percentage has kind of gone, the Black population has gone down since 1872 currently. And so I think there are a lot of different things happening. So I think sometimes when we look at the African American experience, we often only characterize it by the big things that were happening, whether it be Selma and other things. And because they happen on a smaller scale here, I think sometimes we think that it didn't happen. But if you look beneath the surface, it is happening, and it did happen. And I think history is written by the winners, but I think it's kind of hard to look at what's happening in San Antonio. I just think it's a hard city to characterize.
Hard city?
As a person that doesn't come from here.
Well, yeah, but okay, so what when I'm looking at this tricentennial, and we're trying to do an examination of how we arrived at the city that we have today. And that includes many of our self-constructs of like, what do we think about when we think about San Antonio? And when we do that, we want to think about the city in a positive light, in a progressive light. And there's plenty of progressive achievements to celebrate. But also, we did have a lot of terrible things that needed to be acknowledged, that, you know, this was a city of Jim Crow, and this also was a city that was part of the South and part of secession, although San Antonians did reject secession when we had the referendum on that at that time. So, Mario Salas, tell me more about when you want to talk about San Antonio's African-American history. What do you want to talk about?
Well, I always like to start off with the understanding that at one point when the Spanish were in control of the area, and we're talking 1600s, and you could go back further to 1500s, but in 1600s, you're talking about the Spanish having a system that they call the Casta system, in which skin color was the rule from which to place people in different social strata. And as a result of this system, there was created, for any number of reasons, a separation of what was considered white versus what was considered non-white.
It was a caste system.
Yeah, the caste system. And from the evidence I've gathered, I think it's fair to make the assumption that the San Antonio River was perhaps the first line of segregation, meaning that whites, there was no north and south side of town. There was only east and west of the river. And so the river being the west side of the river being for whites, the east side of the river being for blacks. Now, this may have been established through the Casta system long before the Canary Islanders and may have been reinforced by the Canary Islanders. But I do know that some of the original black inhabitants came from Mexico. There was a heavy trade route between the city of Veracruz and San Antonio, as evidenced by Father Morphy, who did a lot of research in his memoirs and travel diaries. And if you look at the population of Veracruz, Mexico at that time, it was heavily inhabited by Angolan slaves and Angolan freemen, probably one of the heaviest populations in Mexico of black people who had been imported either through Havana via Africa or directly from Africa into the Mexican coast. So when I look at the east side, the home of African Americans in the present sense, we're talking about a long, long history of the east side being a place where blacks had to go as a result of this system of segregation.
And when you say a long history of that, I mean basically from the city's inception, that according to your research, you're saying that that was part of the way that the city evolved and grew up that way. And that's kind of, and we look back, why is the east side today where we see a large percentage, but also of African Americans, but throughout the San Antonio's history, there were other pockets of African Americans that were on the west side and mm-hmm. off Zarzamora mm-hmm. near Little Flower. There was a big a neighborhood. And so it's, and then no more. You know what happened?
Yeah, and that northern enclave of African Americans was probably the far most western stretches of an area called Newcombville, yeah. And Newcombville obviously established, and there is some evidence to suggest it was named after James Newcomb, one of the founders of the Express. I think it was called Alamo Express or whatever it was.
Right, the Alamo Express.
Yeah. And Newcomb was a unionist who was in control in one degree or another of the black vote because, of course, when the Confederates lose the Civil War, Newcomb becomes a political boss himself and forms a relationship with another political boss, the black guy who came before Charles sure. Bellinger, which was Lafayette Walker.
We'll talk about all that, but Newcomb, of course, was driven out of San Antonio by the Knights of the Golden Circle. They set up a noose for him in front of the Alamo. They were going to lynch him, and he rode down Commerce Street with his shotgun saying, "Catch me if you can." We'll talk more about him when the source continues. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. We'll be back. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about San Antonio's rich, deep, complex African-American history. If you want to tell us the stories that you know, a lot of this is oral tradition. We want to hear your stories. Number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. We've had many standout leaders here in San Antonio. They deserve their time in the sun as we talk about Tricentennial and the many moments that have shaped the city throughout the years. And Carrie Lattimore, associate professor and chair of the history department at Trinity University, you're not from San Antonio. You come to San Antonio and you look at the history here, and what do you see?
I see a very diverse community, and that seems like a it seems obvious, but it truly is. You have a city that the African-American population is not a majority-minority population. You have a city that has a legacy of slavery, but you also have a city that has a different kind of relationship, a more benign, because that doesn't necessarily mean that it doesn't exist, but we don't have the pictures of the hoses and the other kinds of things that you have in other southern cities. And so I think that sometimes in San Antonio kind of lulls us to sleep about the realities of life in San Antonio, because even though we didn't have that, you still have a legacy of segregation. You have a legacy of slavery. You have a legacy of stories being forgotten and kind of left out. And I think what sometimes intensifies it is that there's this thought that if you don't have the more visceral racism, overtly visceral racism, that it doesn't exist. And so it's more it's an undercurrent that's kind of there on the underbelly, but it just bubbles up consistently, I think. And so San Antonio, to me, is an interesting city because you've just got a lot of trends going on here that are just different from cities like Houston, cities like Dallas, cities like Atlanta, it's a city that's a hard city to handle. And I think that's one of the reasons why it probably receives less attention than other cities. But it's an intriguing city, one of vast differences, one of differing black communities. I mean, you have a lot of black people who say that we're West Siders, but we often see the black community as only East Side. And so there are these competing images of, you know, how a black community should be or what the black community is, even though it's 6 to 8%. So that there's a lot of vibrancy here that is on the undercurrent that's just waiting to kind of bubble up, I think.
Well, right now we're seeing a lot of growth and redevelopment in San Antonio, and people are very cautious about things like gentrification, and we're worried about bulldozing of important landmarks that might be critical to one community, like on the east side, and say, right, this is an important place. We don't want to see this lost. And then, but, you know, the developer didn't care, and land gets sold and things get knocked down. So we have to, this is a critical time for us to identify what's important to African-American history and some landmarks and some locations and saying this needs to be preserved. There's money out there to do this, but we've got to organize and we got to tell these stories. And so, Mario Salas, is this something that you're concerned with?
Oh, definitely. As a matter of fact, as a member of the city's TIF board, I was able to get funding for several monuments that we've placed in the city. One over the original home of Mount Zion First Baptist Church. We constructed a plaque there indicating that this was the area in which Mount Zion First Baptist Church.
That's now San Antonio Housing Authority, right?
Yes and no. It's now the Victoria Commons, which has both public and private housing on the site. It used to be the Victoria Courts, which at one time was an all-white housing project. And I've got another historical marker in front of the original, I'll say the second original home of St. Paul Methodist Church. I was able to put one there as well. And then another historical marker in the African-American cemetery. What Dr. Lattimore said was absolutely correct. And I would just add that part of the history of this town, which makes it so unique, is it's tied to Mexico in so many ways. Mexico had a black president named Vicente Guerrero. He abolished slavery. And despite the villainization of Santa Ana, he might have been a villain to the slave owners, but wherever Santa Ana went, he freed slaves. And so this makes it all the more interesting in terms of the black population. He freed slaves, interestingly enough, during the time that the J.C. Sace celebrations were going on. So that means J.C. Sace is not just a Mexican holiday. It ought to be a black holiday on top of that, because that's when slavery was abolished in Mexico, which is where we're sitting right now at that time.
Sorry, Guerrero called for the immediate abolition of slavery in Mexico on September 16th, 1829. But the Dies Irae, the decimeter that we celebrate from Father Hidalgo, that happened in 1810.
Right.
So just to make that distinction.
Yeah, you can make that distinction, but also you have to understand what's done on the same time.
Yeah, same date. All right, let's get a caller in on this. Number is 210-614-8980. And the Camela, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you. I had a quick question for Mario. Last night I was with the Oversight Committee for the Creeks, and we were discussing the San Pedro Creek and the interpretations of history that are going into the cultural interpretation there, and we're discussing what was planned in terms of the African-American Black history there, and I wanted to have your suggestions for that.
All right, Camilla, thank you for the call. So Mario Salas?
Well, gosh, I could go on and on and on for hours about that one. But I would say you have to start with the original why the East Side became the black part of town. You have to start there, and then you got to move through the Civil War period and Reconstruction, and then move up into present day. You know, no one likes to talk about San Antonio mayors being slave owners, but if you look at the 1855 city directory, you will see that Mayor King owned an auction house at Main Plaza. Mayor Carolyn owned an auction house at Main Plaza. Francois Giraud was also a slave owner who dealt in slaves near the Minger Hotel. So we have a history, might have not have been as overt as Dr. Lattimore said, that's true. But we also have records of San Antonio mayors who were owned slaves, owned slave auction blocks. And there's a couple of incidences where one writer, who I believe his name was Robert Miner, talked about a mob of people chasing a black man across Alamo Plaza, trying to hang him. And then subsequently a severed thumb of a black man being shown off in one of the saloons in downtown San Antonio. So we've got smaller incidents of this kind of horror. But we do have them, as Dr. Lattimore pointed out. So, I mean, you got to go through the whole gambit. You got to start off with the Spanish input, and go through that whole Costa system, and go through Reconstruction. The mayors that before that, the mayors that owned slaves, and then Lafayette Walker. I mean, we haven't talked him about very much, but he's the one that Charles Bellinger inherited the entire system from. We have a nonpartisan city council election. Lafayette Walker is directly responsible for that setup.
Yeah, it's amazing how history today, we live it, and even though we don't understand how we got to where we are today. But Carrie Lattimore, so as we talk about San Antonio's history, and Mario Salas is talking about some of the horrors that San Antonio has participated in those eras, can we gradate those degrees of horror? I mean, yeah, we did not have the Waco Holocaust. Oh. But, you know,
Oh, certainly not, and I wouldn't want to say that. I just think that sometimes in our national view of this, we're always linked to the big event that's on the news. That's why we remember it. And there's sometimes always this linkage between, especially with African-American history, it's unless if people are consistently seen dying or hoses are going, that we don't think that these things are happening in other places. And I think San Antonio, perhaps sometimes, even African-Americans sometimes talked about a more benign racism here, especially in the 1960s, when it was still here.
Okay, benign racism is an oxymoron.
It is. But I think sometimes we as people take that in and we say, okay, well, it's not as bad there as here. It's almost like saying, well, that slave master, you know, when I used to work at Carter's Grove in Virginia, Colonial Williamsburg, people would say, well, was he a good slave master? Was he a really nice slave master? He's still a slave master. So I'm not saying that I'm not giving it an excuse. I'm just saying that I think sometimes in our perception, that's probably why it gets less attention than it really should. And I think sometimes we say it's benign and not recognize it, and we're still saying it exists and we should address it and look at it.
If I might add to that, part of the reason for that is our proximity to Mexico. There is ample primary source documents that indicate you would actually have slave owners making comments like, let's not be too rough on our slaves in their San Antonio area because they can just walk that 150 miles and be out of here.
And many of them did. There was an underground railroad in San Antonio and we can talk about that. But I want to get another caller on the air. And I certainly want to focus on many of the positive accomplishments that we have in our African-American community, many of our great leaders that we've had. And this is Julian. Hi, Julian. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, yeah. Thank you for having this conversation. I was fascinated by the trade route between Veracruz and San Antonio. And I was wondering, I've always heard that there were Africans here before the slave trade from the Caribbean and Central America. Are there any notable African Americans that were in San Antonio that were not slaves, say employed by the Spanish or just merchants or whatever?
All right, Julian, thank you for that. I appreciate that.
Samuel McCullough.
Yeah. there were... In Spanish society, you could move from one position, social status, to another, sometimes dependent upon skin color, but also dependent upon what kind of skills you brought.
So your class.
Yeah. Were you a blacksmith? Did you know stuff about dealing with cattle and all of that? So you would have had Africans and Afro-Mexicans and African-Americans having those kinds of skills that would not have been slaves, but would have been, I want to say, in some cases, sliding under the radar because they had a skill and would be viewed differently than a slave who was only doing manual labor in a field. I don't have specific names going back that far. I know there are some, but I don't have specific names at this particular moment in front of me. I know there were some. I think Dr. Henry Louis Gates even pointed out, and not that I'm advocating this, but black conquistadors actually followed Cortez in the taking over of the Aztec Empire. We never hear anything about black conquistadors.
So when you're talking about black conquistadors, are you talking about Moors?
Moors, people of African descent, Moorish people. You know, the word Moor comes generally derived from the word Morocco. And by the way, anybody whose last name is Moor, that means you're dark, or you have an ancestor that's dark. I told that to an Anglo guy the other day, and he went, "What?" And he went and looked it up himself and said, "You know what? I'm shocked."
Yeah.
Could I also make to piggyback off of Mr. Salas, and the idea of a racial caste or a casting system is so much different than what we think of traditional as American, whereas one drop, you're black, you're white. So you have that two-tiered system versus a Spanish, and one could argue French too, in which you've got a more gradation of viewpoint of color, but also class status. And I think it's much easier to look at the strategically black-white dynamic than all of the others. So San Antonio and other cities like that are much more complex to even look at than this black-white dynamic.
But also, as you pointed out, Mario Salas, that Texas under Mexico, when it was part of Mexico, it was emancipated, and there were people who, African-American slaves, who fled to Texas to escape slavery in the South, and they came here, and some who managed to acquire their freedom legitimately came to Texas to settle here. And when Texas became an independent republic, they immediately told all freed slaves or non-slaved blacks that they had to leave. They expelled during the time of the Texas Republic. It was certainly set up to be, pro-slavery and not accepting of anything else.
Yeah, and what often happens is they bring up exceptions to the rule, like Sam McCullough Jr., who was given all this acreage of land because he fought for the Texan side in the Revolution. Well, he fought for the slave owners, but nevertheless, they blow that up without ever saying that on the day the Alamo fell, there were hundreds of black soldiers not in the Alamo fighting for slave owners. They were fighting for Santa Ana. That's never pointed out. Mexico even had an all-black regiment called the Free Blacks of Veracruz. In Spanish, it's Los Morenos Libres de Veracruz. That's been erased from the history books, but it's there in all kinds of primary source documentation. So we haven't been hearing that other side.
All right, we're talking about history of San Antonio, and this is the history of the African-American community. We want to hear the stories that you may have heard from your family members. The oral history is important, and we're trying to bring it to the fore today, tell these stories now so they don't get lost. Give us a call. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. Who are the heroes of San Antonio's African-American history that you want saluted today? Please call. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about San Antonio's rich, deep, complex African-American history. It is here. It is real. It needs to be told. It needs to be part of our citywide celebration of our tricentennial. What do you want us to remember when we talk about our African-American history in San Antonio? How can we be more inclusive in our celebration? And how can we bring these stories up right now so that more people will hear them and know them and keep them alive? Give us a call. The number is 210-614-8980. 210-614-8980. Andrea is on the line. Andrea, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi. This is an oral something that was just passed down to me by a friend. Evidently, there was a department store in San Antonio named Josky's that had a fabulous restaurant where black people were not allowed, of course, to dine.
It was the tea room.
Yes. And a lady named Cecilia Scott went from church to church and addressed everyone who had an account at Josky's and asked them, we're telling them we're closing our accounts, we're shutting it down, and we will not shop at Josky's. And supposedly on some day, whatever day they deemed, there was a line around the entire department store, and within an hour, they were allowed to go in and eat in the tea room. Now, I don't know how factual that is. That's just the story that's been handed down in my family.
Andrea, thank you for that great story. I appreciate it. And so I know that there was policies like that at Josky's in the tea room, not just against African-Americans, but also against Mexican-Americans as well. So, Mario Salas, do you...
Well, I'm old enough to remember Josky's when it was segregated. And I'm old enough to remember the Majestic Theater when it was segregated. And old enough to remember when the Municipal Auditorium, now called the Tobin Center, had a rope down the middle of the aisleway. And the rope was put in place by the San Antonio Fire Department of that time that said colored on one side and white on the other. So we lived in a town that had quite a lot of segregation, not only against blacks, but Mexican Americans, as you pointed out. And the Josky's incident, that's a special thing for me, because I had to be 10 years old when I experienced one of the first demonstrations. I was on my way to see King Kong versus Godzilla at one of the theaters there. I must have been 10, maybe 12, something like that. And they were demonstrating in front of there. And this lady, who was not very old at the time, handed me a leaflet because I was like, what are y'all doing? And she told me that they were demonstrating against segregation at Josky's. Well, I always remembered that. And I kept on going. And it must have been, I don't know, 30 years later, I actually met that old lady who was still alive. Her name was Lillian Sutton Taylor, the sister of G.J. Sutton. And we reminisced about that, and I told her, you gave me a leaflet, and now I see you later in life. And that, in many ways, was part of the reasons why I joined the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. So the story that the young lady just indicated to us is very, very true. There were all kinds of demonstrations against segregation led by Reverend Black and Harry Burns and other people with the church who fought very hard to eliminate segregation in a town that had a segregationist mayor by the name of McAllister.
Could I also say that in regards to segregation, there wasn't a real desegregation ordinance until 1965.
Right.
So you had this whole process of where the city thought that they could kind of voluntarily desegregate and try to, based on, you know, whether people would go along with desegregation, and some people obviously didn't go in that direction. So I think this again shows a sign of the idea of voluntary is almost like thinking, well, it's benign enough that we can work with this and make it work, but it didn't really work until you kind of force people to desegregate.
But how San Antonio achieved that ordinance,
yeah,
it has a story. It's an incredible story, and it involves a bunch of, I think it was 7 African-American kids going to Woodlawn Pool. At the time, it was a whites-only pool, and it was on Juneteenth. They showed up at that pool, and they all jumped in. And they broke, and it was like there was no actual ordinance saying that they couldn't do it.
Never was in San Antonio, if I'm thinking right.
Right, there never was.
And unlike other cities.
It was just understood. And so they called the cops, and they shut the pool down, not just that pool, but all the pools down. And then they had an emergency city council meeting that night. And then also that night in front of the pool, the Ku Klux Klan burned a cross in front of Woodlawn Lake Pool. Mm-hmm. And that's in the newspaper, you know. And so and after that, they passed that ordinance. And they couldn't put that ordinance into place immediately because they needed a unanimous vote from the city council to do that. And the one person who held out, wouldn't let that happen, was Henry B. Gonzalez. So, but then this ordinance only stood for 2 years, and it was unanimously repealed. So, yeah, we had that ordinance. Yeah, we had that black stain on San Antonio's on our cloak. But then we removed it. But, you know, I wonder, my question is, how progressive is the city? How much of a history do we have? How do we look at all of these things in context and try to come up with some sort of picture about where are we with our history in San Antonio?
You know, real quick, there's a San Antonio activist. He's now very old. His name was Vashon Bird. He told me he was one of those kids who did that demonstration. And I said, well, where did y'all go to swim? And he said, in the creek right across the street from Woodlawn. I said, will you show me? I picked him up house. Yeah, I picked him up at his house. He took me to the exact spot where they used to swim, and because they couldn't swim in Woodlawn swimming pool. And then I said, did y'all ever approach it? And then he told me about the story you just told. But he also said, what did they say to you? And he said that the manager of the pool said, we can't let you swim in the same water. We'd have to drain the pool before white people would want to jump in the pool after you guys got out. And so I'm very familiar with that story, having known one of the people who was a victim of that. So is San Antonio progressive? In many ways it is. And in some ways its history is just as southern as Mississippi. But the progression, I think, comes in from a number of ways. Some people always ask me, why do we have one of the largest marches in the country? Well, there are Mexican-Americans marching with us. There are white people marching with us. There's blacks from Selma, Church, Alamo Heights now. There are blacks from Converse, from Cibolo, from all over the place marching. And because you're a population that's so low, 6%, 7%, 8%, that makes you fight all the more harder. And I was talking to some leaders from Houston, mm-hmm. and they often ask me, how did you ever get the state to honor Martin Luther King? I said, well, just simply we took away their football. And that's a whole other story.
Right.
But he did say that why was San Antonio more progressive than Houston? I said, well, when you've got a smaller population, we fight harder.
Okay, so let me get some callers on the air, and there's a lot of ground to cover. I'm sorry this is only an hour, but we've got to try and cover some more ground. This is John. John, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yes. Thank you, David. Many years ago, I was blessed with being friends with a noted San Antonian historian named Henry Guerra, and we had a conversation about why Berg's Mill, just to the north of Mission San Juan, I asked Henry, why didn't they ever put up a marker on the ruins of Berg's Mill just to the east of the newer flood channel done in the 60s? And he said, well, it was quite simple. The Bexar County Historical Society objected to the fact that some people had suggested mentioning that Berg's Mill was established on property that had previously belonged to a noted Texas Revolutionary scout named Hendrick Arnold, who was a freedman. And he and his sons were the first people in 1836 that occupied that land grant that this freedman, former slave, had been granted for services to the Texas Revolutionary Army. And I wondered if any of the guests are familiar with the story of Hendrick Arnold, whose wife was a Hispanic woman whose sister was married to another famous Texian of the period, John Smith.
All right, John, thank you for the question. And Mario Salas or Carrie Lattimore?
This happened not in very many times, but it did happen. And I mentioned Sam McCullough Jr., who actually married a white person before the laws of interracial marriage went into effect. He was given all this acreage, and Arnold was another one. And so the problem with it, though, is their lives were always in jeopardy, because at any moment the law could change. And at any moment people were hammering and clamoring for, why are you giving these black people, as they would have said it then, this land and these rights? So black people who were freed lived a precarious existence. You never were completely free. It may have been on paper, but you always had to worry about whatever violence may come your way. So the story he's telling is fairly accurate from what I gather. And Arnold was not the only one. There were several. But they all had to go through an act of the Texas legislature for that to happen, but their lives were never quite completely free.
And that's
free.
One thing that unites free African Americans throughout the whole country. You know, even in the South, there were some, one historian referred to them as slaves without masters, because in a sense you live a life of privileges but not rights, and those privileges can be taken away at will and often were.
Yeah, that's something that I think needs to be talked about, how conditional whiteness and how you have progress won is progress that can be lost if we don't keep in mind the struggle and how things were achieved and the people who played a role in doing that. I want to talk about these people when we come back from this break. You know, Ella Austin, and we've mentioned Charles Bellinger, but we haven't talked about who he actually is, and other people in San Antonio, Reverend Claude Black, others. Who were these people? What did they do for us in San Antonio? Why did they need to be remembered today? And our phone number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about African-American history here in San Antonio. I do want to mention that there is an event happening tomorrow, Authentic Historic Preservation of African-American History and Place in San Antonio. Everett Fly will be talking about this. He's a San Antonio native architect, National Humanities Medalist. We'll discuss the historic preservation of African-American landmarks in San Antonio and the influence of the community way of life and organization on architecture and landscape. It'll be happening at Texas A&M University at the main campus, and that will be tomorrow. And so back to our topic as we talk about this, let's get Ian on the air. And Ian, welcome to The Source. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I really appreciate the program today, especially as someone like me. I'm a fairly new San Antonian, black as well. And I've had a lot of conversations with my friends who are also Hispanic who talk a lot about people that have lived here for some time. Talk about an animosity that often exists or kind of is an undercurrent between Hispanic and black relations here in the city. Excuse me. And I was wondering, what is that about? Is that an actual thing? Is there a place where I can find resources to understand the history of that a little bit more? Yeah, that's essentially my question.
All right, Ian, thank you for the call. And he's asking about tensions between the two minority populations in San Antonio, not minority anymore, the Latino population. But, you know, there's always that, I guess, competition, who's going to be the golden minority, you know?
Yeah. Well, back some time ago, early 1900s, in some parts of South Texas, including San Antonio, they made an arbitrary decision to label the Mexican-American population as white. So you'll see on many Mexican-American birth certificates, it says white. And part of that was because they had this boss politics system going on, especially in the Valley, white political bosses who wanted to control votes and get their person elected had to have a person's ethnic designation changed in order so they could vote. So many Mexican Americans were labeled as white, and you'll still see that even to this day. And as a result of being labeled white, some, and definitely not all, began to identify themselves that way. And so then this conflict was created. It's historical conflict created from that point of view. Now, there are many people that tried their best to rectify that after the fact. But we're left with that stigma.
So, but we had the class apart Supreme Court decision that was argued by Gus Garcia, where they were able to get a Supreme Court decision saying that Mexican Americans, Latinos, were a protected class, although they were not a distinct, not African American. So, I want to talk about some of these people that we've mentioned earlier, Charles Bellinger. Okay, so Charles Bellinger was called the Black Boss of San Antonio. He controlled the city in many ways, particularly through the use of the vote. And he was an astonishing person. And Kerry, Lattimore, do you want to talk about him?
You know, Bellinger is an interesting person. He's, you know, in some ways, when you say boss, that's exactly right. I mean, he owned a lot of money, had a lot of houses, but was a shrewd politician. He knew how to work with anybody who would work with him, and because he was able to work with them and because he was able to produce votes, in a sense, he had a whole community that would be willing, sometimes by pressure because he held the mortgage to their houses sometimes, to ascertain their vote, and he could then maneuver with politicians to get things on the east side.
And so we're talking about what era?
This is, would be the 20s and the 30s.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, and he started the San Antonio Register.
Right.
Which was a African-American newspaper, not just for San Antonio, but for Texas right. and across the South. Was a very much, very well-respected.
And his son was the editor, Valmo, correct?
That's and correct. The way that newspaper started has a great story, and I'm sure you know it, Mario.
Oh, my God. Bellinger did a lot of things. He paid the poll taxes for people, and then would fill up his cabs with groceries sometimes, go pick up, take the receipts of those poll taxes, which you could do at that time, give them to the cab drivers and go to that person's house and say, here's your groceries, now we need to go vote, and Mr. Bellinger is telling you to vote for Mayor Quinn, or whoever it was at that particular time.
So, who was not a very savory character himself.
That's right. He was a pro-Klansman mayor.
And so people wonder, why was Charles Bellinger supporting a pro-Klan mayor? Well, Bellinger was able to trade for that. He got streets paved. He got plumbing brought into utilities and other things brought into the east side of town, and was able to really provide a quality of life for the African-American community here in San Antonio that you really didn't see across the South.
I think what he was doing was almost the same thing that Booker T. Washington did a couple of decades earlier. You know, there's always this discussion of economic development versus civic equality. And I think Bellinger, recognizing civic equality, was willing to work with people who were willing to work with him. If you look at the history of Tuskegee Institute, it's set up the same way. You have these black African-American bosses who are working with Democrats, and they were able to ascertain concessions. Bellinger does the same thing in a period of tremendous racial segregation and racial oppression. He was willing to work with anybody who would be willing to provide services for the black community. So I think we should look at
it
differently.
He's a pragmatist.
Yeah, he's a pragmatist. Whatever works.
So he ran into conflict with Maury Maverick, a person that people think of as a huge progressive liberal in San Antonio. And when it came to race, not so much. And so talk about that.
Well, Maverick once called Belmo Bellinger a black baboon. And because Bellinger would be supporting one side of the political spectrum for mayor, and of course Maverick would be supporting the other side, and they would disagree on that. And so as a result of Bellinger could literally decide who is going to be mayor in San Antonio. That is a story that's
sure.
very unique.
So we had in Texas the white primary system, and that was put in place specifically because of San Antonio's high turnout of African-American vote. And Maury Maverick fought against the repeal of the white primary system. And that's, when you read about that and you hear all the stories about Maury Maverick, that just blows your mind.
Yeah, he's not the great liberal he was made
or
out
you
to
got
be.
To put him in context. Everything is complicated, but there are some people we need to talk about. Okay, Ella Austin. We hear about Ella Austin Center, but who was Ella Austin?
I'll let you talk about
okay.
Ella Austin.
Ella Austin had one of the black orphanages here in San Antonio, the only black orphanage at one time. And we have a community center named after her that's still in existence to this day. She's buried in the cemetery on the corner of Montana and South New Braunfels Street. And she's very active in terms of getting older and younger African-American women to support an effort to take care of the children who had no parents. So she did a tremendous job with trying to help those people out. I was very young. I'm 12 years old. We used to walk by the orphanage, and some of the kids who were upstairs in the orphanage would holler out at us through the window, and I'll never forget that. And we'd walk by there because one of the young kids, of course, we were 12, 13 years old, would say, there's some pretty girls up there. So as we were walking by, we'd get those comments. And but all jokes aside, Ella Austin did a wonderful job of trying to take care of the orphaned black children because they had nowhere else to go in this town. And everything was segregated. And so in a segregated society in San Antonio, blacks, carried the weight of, okay, we've got to create an institution to help our community because they're not going to help us.
And to that, let's mention, let's talk about Artemisia Bowden. And because of her, we have St. Philip's College today.
Yeah, and that's an interesting story, too, and a lot of people don't like me telling this story, but I'm going to. The college, and Dr. Latimer was getting to that. Many of these colleges were started as part of the Redeemer Movement by the Southern slave owners, now former slave owners after the Civil War. They did not want blacks going to their schools. So they would find entrepreneurs or people who believed in philanthropy to donate land to black people to keep them from going to their schools. James Steptoe Johnson was a Civil War veteran on the Confederate side, captured by Union forces, became a bishop, came back to San Antonio, and the Episcopalian Church at that time didn't want to empower black people with academic skills. So his whole idea of creating St. Philip's was to train blacks in trades that would service the needs of whites. And so the black community got tired of that and started clamoring for a black person to be over St. Philip's. And that's how Miss Bowden got to be where she was. And that's not to say that St. Philip's didn't do its best under a segregated system, and Miss Bowden didn't do her best under that segregated system, but they inherited, many of these black colleges inherited as a direct result of Robert E. Lee and the Redeemer Movement not wanting blacks to go to their churches or their colleges.
So that perfectly illustrates how complex things are. It's very difficult to put things in certain categories. There's some give and take with progress. Things are frequently three steps forward, two steps back. So Carrie Lattimore, how do we tell that narrative?
I think the easiest, I shouldn't say the easiest way, but the best way to tell that narrative is to basically be open with who we are and to come up, you know, hearing about these people that we've talked about, and there are others, you know, like Prudence Curry. You know, she's the head of, you know, the head of the Carver Library for years. G.J. Sutton. There are other people looking at allies. You've got Jacobson, Rabbi Jacobson. You've got the Catholic priest. What was his? Lucy. Looking at all
these stories. Archbishop Lucy, he desegregated the Catholic school system here in San Antonio 2 years before for Brown versus the Board of Education.
Absolutely.
And that created a pathway to desegregate all of San Antonio's public schools.
So I think that looking at all of these people, but then putting it in a context of saying we're going to be very open with what our history is, recognize that even if it is benign, this legacy exists, but even in the space of this benign racism, black people form places of where they achieved tremendous and amazing things. Armitage Bowden, you know, you've got St. Philip's. Look at it.
Right.
Segregation, but progress.
So we only got about 30 seconds, Mario Salas. Please don't go over. But this is exciting. This is interesting. This is compelling stories. You know, this belongs to all of us, even if you're not African American.
That's true, because black history is American history. Yeah. It's not just black history. It's American history. Every single book you can think of, every discipline you can think of, every chapter of every book ought to have what blacks contributed to that particular discipline. And I think, finally, the Tricentennial is trying to do that.
All right, and if you want to find links and information about what the Tricentennial is doing about African-American history in San Antonio, we're going to have that on our website at tpr.org. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for tuning us in.